This episode of the Agile Uprising podcast is brought to you by Lightspeed's Agile DC Executive Summit. Learn more at agiledcsummit.com.
This is Joshua Karajewski. You are listening to the Agile Uprising podcast.
Hello and welcome to another edition of the Agile Uprising podcast. I'm your host today, James Gifford. As we work through our Lean series, we have the pleasure of speaking with Mary and Tom Popendick today. We're also joined by Agile Uprising member Ryan Lockhart. And we really want to hats off to Mary and Tom in all the work that they've kind of contributed over the years. So Mary and Tom, for the listeners that may not know who you are, or haven't had a chance to happen upon your works, could you guys give us a introduction to yourselves?
Sure. I got involved in Agile in the early 2000s. I worked for 3M for about 20 years and left in 1999, first day of 1999. And while I was at 3M, I worked other places before 3M, but while I was at 3M, I did software in a line division. I was actually an IT manager in a manufacturing plant. I did engineering software to control machines, big coding machines and big makers for videotape. And when I was in a manufacturing plant, I got involved in lean manufacturing. It wasn't called lean at the time because it predated lean. It was just in time. And when I did an early retirement from 3M, I took a look at what was going on in the software world, and I ran into this thing called waterfall, which didn't make any sense to me. And I thought I was missing something, but I wasn't. It didn't really work. So after getting involved in some software projects that tried to use waterfall and failed, I decided I would write a book about how those lean concepts we used in manufacturing could be used in developing software. Some of the fundamental underlying principles, not the actual practices, but some of the principles. And Tom joined the business shortly after I started and helped me write the first book. And we wrote three other books after that on the entire concept of lean in software development.
I started out as a physicist, taught in the university for 7 years, and moved into industry where I contributed to bringing lean manufacturing into Honeywell commercial flight systems that made navigation computers, and in addition brought process automation that integrated the whole life cycle from the initial design all the way through the production and operation sheets, an early predecessor of what we today call DevOps. So I worked for a while as an enterprise architect and various other titles in different companies. But I basically had contact through Mary and through my work at Honeywell with the automation and lean manufacturing for quite a few years.
That's great. I think, Mary, with you and Tom's background in the early days of the lean and agile movement, I'm curious, when you first started going, where were you acquiring the experience and learning beyond what you experienced at 3M in your previous lean environments? Where were you, which thought leaders were you looking into and collaborating with to flesh out how the concepts you brought forward?
I have to say, none. When I first got back involved in software, I had been doing other types of product development when I was at 3M. And when I left, I got back involved in software projects. And I ran into this thing called an Agile Manifesto. And I got involved with some of the people that were trying to start up Agile Alliance. And I got involved in working to establish it. I think when I wrote my first book, it was part of a series from Alistair Coburn and Jim Highsmith. And they gave me advice on how to start the book. And I really liked Jim's ideas about adaptive software development. And because it just resonated with me. That's like, that's the way you develop software. Why is this even worth discussing? I really did not have a lot of experience with what people think of as traditional software development ever. So most of my ideas came from the way I saw work getting done throughout my entire career in both software and in manufacturing. When there were ideas that I disagreed with, I basically did a mental jump back into my manufacturing plant and tried to figure the moral equivalent of what was going on in a manufacturing environment and try to figure out the principles that applied to that. For example, I can remember never liking the concept of backlog. A backlog always felt so bad to me, and that's because I never liked the concept of inventory, because that's what we tried to get rid of in our manufacturing plant and have as little as possible. And so I just always instinctively was against the whole concept of a product backlog, because that meant an inventory of stuff that you wanted to do rather than a sort of just-in-time approach to getting things done. So I think I grew more on analogies to my manufacturing background than anything else when I was trying to take the ideas that I saw and grapple with them.
The other reference that we used, relied on, was the lean product development world.
Yes.
Which is quite different than lean manufacturing. With product development, you encourage diversity. You look to minimize the time from concept to something that can be built. And the lean product development is probably much more similar to lean software development than lean manufacturing. The principles are the same, but there are fundamental differences in context which make the lean product development or lean software development dramatically different in its actual execution.
I have to admit, when looking for things that I read back when I was in the late 90s, I read Preston Smith and Don Reinertsen's Developing Products in Half the Time. I was very influenced by it. And then sort of the model for the first book that I wrote was Don Reinertsen's Managing the Design Factory. The kinds of concepts and themes that he had were really the kinds of fundamental to mine. So I guess if I would say there was any influence at all, it would have to be Don Reinertsen.
That's great. I think in your lean product development works, you take the seven principles of lean manufacturing and you map them to the principles of lean product development. And then you do the same with the seven wastes. And I always get a little bit of a chuckle when you go through the seven different wastes and you do the mapping, and then you get to I think it's usually number seven is defects. And it's like defects equals defects. So it's
right.
I'm not sure if there's humor intended in the way that that's written, but it definitely, when I read it in my head, it always gives me a little bit of a smirk on my face. There are some things that need no translation.
That's right.
And I do want to share with you guys, when we went through a previous series where we tried to interview as many of the Agile Manifesto authors as we could, of which we got 14 of the 17, it was Martin Fowler who said that, hey, this is a great exercise that you guys are going through, but there's probably 17 other people that are as important, if not more important than us, that you need to speak to. And one of the first names that Martin said was Mary and Tom Papendick. So I think, it's interesting. You said that you came into the Agile Manifesto, and the folks that crafted that look to you as one of the founders of the movement that we're enjoying today.
Cool. I remember when I was first thinking of writing anything about how manufacturing ideas might apply, I talked to Martin Fowler and I said, so how do I do this? And he said, oh, publish an article. He told me the magazine to publish it in, and he always encouraged me ever since.
When you guys were working through the different models that existed, the different frameworks, obviously in the Agile space, there's Scrum, and then there's, you mentioned Alistair, so he was working with his Crystal Clear method for a little while. There was DSDM that was sort of prevalent in the early days. But Scrum started off with a pretty good, bit of a momentum, and then it hasn't really looked back since. And we talked a little bit about the product backlog, but I think it's worth just diving into the role of a product owner for a minute, because I think you guys have a pretty unique take on the effectiveness of that role and if there's better representations of the voice of customer on a development team.
Sure. Scrum has had good marketing and has been successful partly because it's a how-to manual. And when you're new at something and very much a novice, a book that says how-to is probably the thing that you're looking for most. But when I think about Lean, I think of it as not a hard how-to manual for sure. It's the theory behind the how-to. So why do you do this? And the reason after you get started that that's important is because I don't care what set of practices you start with, they have to grow and change over time. And when you start with the theory behind why you're doing something and you get to be more expert in the area, then you know how to make the proper changes. You know what needs to be questioned and what needs to be changed and what needs to be criticized and that sort of thing. So when it comes to the product owner, I have never ever liked the concept of product owner as described in the classic Scrum manuals, because when I did product development at 3M, and I did quite a bit of it, we had a slightly different take on what a product leader did. And it was not set priorities. You know, when I was at 3M, I put teams together that put products on the market. And the idea that I would give the team priorities is really kind of amusing to me, because many of my teams were volunteers. And that was the fastest way to lose volunteers, is to even begin to think about telling them what to do. So what you do as a product champion is you care deeply about the success of the product, and you do what's necessary to pull together a group of people that will make that product successful. And you inspire them to be their best and to think their most creative thoughts, and to work hard in their both on and off time to figure out how to make that product successful. And so at 3M, we had this saying is there's no product champion, there's no product, because the product champion sort of breathes life into the idea. If you think about leading a volunteer team, I don't care whether it's a bunch of after curricular sports team or a music group or whatever. And you think about what you need to do to lead a volunteer team. You need to inspire them to come back all of the time and to do their best when they're working together. And to me, that's what a product champion does. And they do it because when random people get together to accomplish something, they like to have somebody who cares very much about their success, making sure that everything is going in the right direction, but leaning on the best capabilities of everybody there. So if you have what I have perceived in many implementations, the product owner being a go out and figure out what needs to be done and translate that to the team, you have a handover, you have a translator, and you turn the team into order takers rather than into thinkers. And a product manager is a little bit different. It's a classic term that's been around a long time. And especially as Marty Kagan uses the word product manager, I think it's much, much better, because it's an idea of a person who tries to gather together all of the general ideas of what does it take to make this product successful, and then leverage the capabilities of all of the folks that they have available to them to make that product successful, whatever that means. But again, this is theory versus practice. And theory tells you how to think about something, and practice says, do this, do this, do this. And maybe way back in the beginning, when we had new software engineering teams forming, we needed somebody to tell them what to do and set priorities. But I should hope that's not what we need today. What we need is we need somebody to inspire the team as to what the problem is that they're trying to solve, and probably come up with a way for the team to know that they're headed in the right direction. So typically, what kind of thing are we going to use to measure success? And can we measure it incrementally? For example, a product manager at a company that I went to once in Norway, basically every few months would talk to the team and say, here's the main things I would like to accomplish in the next quarter. And then they would have a lot of discussion about what was practical and what was possible and what might be earlier rather than later. And one of the things that she also did was she put a big screen up with metrics coming in from the website that they were running that were immediate. And they flashed between about six different metrics as we walked in their work area. So I went up to an arbitrary developer and I said, so, you know, that screen up there, do you ever look at it? And he says, oh yeah, for sure. I said, so what do you see? Well, there's only one that really matters, and that's the conversion rate. And we look at that all the time because every time we release, we can check the conversion rate and see if what we released really did any good. And so they get their feedback from the immediate proper measurement of what it is that they're trying to achieve. And they knew exactly what to do and how to make decisions because they could get feedback, real live, real-time feedback, and figure out their own priorities. So I like to think of a product manager or a product leader as somebody who helps the team by clarifying the vision and understanding how they will know that they're getting along towards success and making sure that all of the tools are necessary so the team can be successful.
And success, of course, is not measured by points, or it's not measured by any project management type metric. It's measured by, is the organization achieving its purpose? The organization in Norway that runs a substantial fraction of the retail volume in the whole of the country had one particular metric that measured whether or not their organization was successful. And every frontline developer looked at the impact of what they did on achieving the organization's goal.
That's great. And then obviously there's been some recent works talking about how every organization has one core metric that drives them. And I don't know what your feeling is on that. And I'm not even sure what my feeling is on that.
I think when we did product development at 3M, we all knew what the proper core metric was for success of our product. And it wasn't how many we sold, and it wasn't how much, it wasn't any of those sorts of things. It was margins. That is, for every individual sale, what was the marginal profit? And that's because what we were trying to do was to create high margin profits that were defensible by patents and constantly replace the things before they became low margin profits. And when you think of an innovative company, that's actually a really good concept of how you might want to run a company like that. So the idea that there is a single metric for the company might or might not be true. But the idea that there is a metric against which a team goal can be measured ought to be true. So I think that what a team should have from its leader is a metric that they're watching, or two or three, which tell them that they're moving in the right direction as they incrementally deploy software. And that's a very important job for the product leader to supply and to make visible. And when that's there, there doesn't need to be too much else done about telling the team what to do or what's important, because they can figure it out for themselves. And when you have a broader group of people coming up with ideas about what to do next, you always get better designs than if you think just one single person can figure it all out.
So I have a quick question based on everything we just said. Do you, what has been your experience with objectives and key results and using OKRs as a way to make visible what the intent and what the metrics are for a team?
So I saw that working quite well in Spotify, although they abandoned it for something similar. So if OKRs are, here's the general high-level objective that we're trying to achieve, and here are the key results that we are looking for in the next interim thing. These are the key metrics that are going to tell us we're heading to that objective. And let's watch whether or not our deployments head that way. Then they can be very useful. I've also seen management by objectives gone wrong. I don't think there's any particular practice that's devoid of possibilities of misuse. But when the company is run by, here's where we're trying to get, and here's the interim steps that we, in the ways that we can measure that we're heading in that direction, that leaves a lot of freedom for the teams on the ground to figure out how they're going to contribute towards going in that direction.
That is a great explanation. It's just really funny working with the teams that we work with, how the having them shift from the actual focus on actual true outcomes has changed the way we do business. And a lot of the ideation stuff that you guys kind of talk about in the third book, and kind of getting into some of the stuff that Toyota was doing with how they develop cars and getting them actually into the field and tested and actually doing that. We've had the opportunity to do that with the last company I was helping out with their mobile platform adoption. They literally had a 1% mobile platform adoption. And as they were rebuilding their platform, their goal was to at least hit a 75% target. And so when they were meeting with the engineers, they it was a pharmaceutical company. Well, it was actually a pharmacy company that did pharmaceutical distributions and things like that. So we kind of went through some of the concepts of your book and about actually how that ideation works. Mm-hmm. And they reluctantly agreed to send a designer and a developer and the product owner, because we couldn't get past that name. But this person was acting in that basically, as you've described, as a product champion. Uh-huh. And with them actually going on site to four different pharmacies, they literally figured out that the biggest pain and the reason that nobody was using the mobile platform was they still needed to rely on this big proprietary scanner. So between between the developer and the designer, they were able to come up with a quick prototype literally by the time they landed back in the Philly area, and showed it and demoed it. And they took it back out to the pharmacies about a month later, because they got all the belt, like a better prototype that was actually integrated with the e-com platform. Uh-huh. And they did this all in a matter of months. Now, it wasn't going to be the most stable or reliant, but that ideation, literally, when they put it in the hands of those four people again, and it was on an iPad. It was on an iPod Touch. They literally were just ecstatic. And they're like, if this actually makes the final cut of your product, I will sign today. If you can confirm with me. And so they had a test base of 100 people. So out of those four, after those four said they would sign today, they went out to the remaining 100, and they literally had 100% adoption of the mobile platform, because the developers got out in the field, they worked with the designer, yeah, and they were actually solving a true problem. And they actually had that sense of purpose that I need to go solve that. So
But not to say anything against the product manager or the product owner who happened to be there, but they may very well not have the background to see that scanner was a problem and a bottleneck, and they can't imagine the technology behind it. Whereas if you have a good designer and a good technical person looking at a system in use, they can oftentimes, because of their background, imagine whole new ways of doing things. So you really need to have that group of people putting their minds together to figure out what should be done. And I really think that this whole concept of design thinking should be thrown into this equation anytime you have something that's used by customers. You know, the early IT systems were all internal process automation. They were not products used by customers for the longest, longest time. And that's where we got the concept that the business, quote unquote, is the customer of the software group called IT. But once you start having real life customers, then you need to have somebody that understands design and technology working, not with an intermediary who's going to filter it all, but directly with the people who are going to use it. And the whole concept of design thinking says you take a diverse group of people and you put them in the shoes of the people that they're trying to design a product for, and you create an empathy with the problems that those people have. Then you're much more likely to come up with a brilliant solution. So Google has this thing called design sprints, which are led always, all the time, by a designer, a user interaction designer, which help a whole bunch of different people of different size groups empathize with a customer problem and come up with a whole slew of creative ways to probably solve the problem, and then take one or two or three of those and focus on it. So if you look at the research, it says that half of the time a product manager has an idea, the idea will not pan out. It will be wrong. Well, why is this bad? It's only bad if we demand that the product manager be right all the time. And if we have a process that requires the product manager's ideas to be right before they're ever validated with people, then we have a process that's bad. So what we need to do is have a process which is more based on design thinking when we're in a product world, which says products are designed with empathy for the people who are going to be using the product. And we need to put in place design practices which allow all of the diverse backgrounds of people on the team to be engaged in figuring out the product direction, where it's going to go, what it can possibly do.
The current DevOps environment that is the dominant thing that's moving way beyond Agile these days allows that to happen very naturally. The key advantage that it gives you is that you can try quick, inexpensive experiments to test out your ideas and get feedback within sometimes a matter of hours on whether this is going to make a difference in achieving your purpose or not. The critical thing is how rapidly can you learn what the right thing to do is. If you have to wait a year and you invest a whole project's worth of money and you find out that it wasn't the right thing to build, you have done something really terrible. And it's not that you did it terribly, it's that the organization wasted most of its assets on something that doesn't work very well.
So Tom, you've brought up DevOps twice now. I just want to make sure that I add to what you're saying. Like, I work in the DevOps space myself. That is that is kind of the core area that I'm in these days. And when I work with clients and I talk to them about what DevOps is, right? Because at this point, it's almost a trigger word. Much like Agile became a trigger word, and MVP is a trigger word, and all these other things. I usually enter the conversation saying that it's the intersection of people, process, and tooling, or people, process, and technology. Yep. And in that order, right? Because I think this conversation will eventually get into value stream mapping. And if we try to force DevOps tools on teams, then we're actually creating a much more fragile system than one where we start with the people and the people define what their current process is. You have empathy for your teams and for your product groups to then come up with the correct tooling to facilitate the process. And I think all of that ties directly into the lean mindset, and it's actually a speed and flow enabler, is how I look at it. And that's why I've kind of repositioned my career to continue down that path. And I just love that you brought it up, because I take it as a sense of confirmation that it's probably the next wave that's going to continue forward.
So what I like to do with DevOps is I like to talk about the objective. And to me, the objective is to get to a point of continuous delivery. Okay, so what you're trying to do is to take an idea, and this gets into value stream mapping, something that's an idea, a possibility, a need from a customer, and get it deployed just as fast as you possibly can with no, safely. And if you want to get it deployed safely, then you have to automate the testing. And if you create a pipeline, then you will be able to take any change in idea and get it out there for real, like within a day. And when you can have that very rapid flow, then dev and ops have to work together, but then so do people who are deciding what to do. Hopefully it's the team. So if I want to avoid that, you know, touch word of DevOps, I tend to say, so what is the objective of DevOps? And to me, the objective of DevOps is very rapid delivery of stuff in a very safe way. That's where the tooling comes in. That's why you need the proper tooling so that you can safely do stuff quickly.
One of our favorite recent reads is Site Reliability Engineering, that describes how Google maintains a reliable availability of all of its products, data centers. And they emphasize also that, yes, tooling is absolutely critical, but it is the passion of the individual reliability engineers that enables their whole environment to work. So I certainly agree with your observation.
Yeah, I don't think resiliency is something you buy. Resiliency is something that you breed into the culture of your organization. You get people that care about outcomes. They don't care about output. And you just go through a cultural shift in that space. So awesome. So in the value stream mapping arena, when I work with new clients, it's one of the best tools I have to come up with a visualization of metrics for the current state. And then after some time in the engagement, when we go and we try to quantify the improvements, we run a value stream map again, and we see what the efficiency increase is over that period of time. Are we getting better? Are we getting worse? And what have we done to impact those outcomes? I'm curious. Value stream maps have been around for a long time, and I don't know that there's been a whole lot of change in how they're created and leveraged. Are you guys still using value stream maps today with the same frequency as you did in the past? And have you changed your purpose and intent with it, or is it the same as it's been?
So there's a book called This Is Lean by Nicholas Modick and Per Ahlstrom. They're from Sweden, and it's a very, very well-selling book in Sweden, one of the best business books around. And it talks about the concept of flow efficiency versus resource efficiency. And the concept of flow efficiency has to do with, from the time somebody has a problem until the time the problem is solved, what percentage of that time is spent actually working on the problem? And that's flow efficiency. Resource efficiency is take a resource, and what percentage of the time is it actually being used? And so much of our software has been organized towards resource efficiency rather than flow efficiency that we're just, you know, like immune to the understanding of what problems resource efficiency adds and how much stuff that we do, wouldn't actually have to be done? How much of that busyness that happens because we're trying to keep all the resources busy would actually not ever have to be done is waste. So when you switch to this concept of flow efficiency, then you have a much better metric of real true efficiency. The first problem being you have to get people to buy that. Once you get people to buy that, then a value stream map is a great way to figure out what flow efficiency is right now today. In fact, that's what a value stream map is doing, is it's basically mapping out and helping you understand your flow efficiency. And it gives you ideas of where the best place to change things is. And so whether or not it's a value stream map, I think the concept of how long does it take to take a problem and actually completely solve it and get the solution into production is the critical question. And a value stream map can be one of any different method of figuring out the answer to that. But the question is, how long does it take from problem to solution? And what percentage of that time is real time that ought to be spent on it because it takes that long to solve the problem? And what percentage of that time is just plain waiting around? And that question was what really changed the way we thought about how we ran our manufacturing plant. If you take any piece of inventory and you walk how long through the plant it's actually being worked on, it was like less than 10%. When we said, well, why is that? We saw a host of problems and wasteful problems that we never saw before. And similarly, you want to look at how long does it take for something to get done and how much of that time is really spent working on it. Because if you have a problem and a customer wants you to solve it, and let's say the problem is a two-day problem, you know what? They might give you a week, but that's it. They'll give you, you know, one sort of cycle of waiting and then get it in your agenda and then solve it. But if it's a two-day problem and you take, you know, 2 months, then the flow efficiency from their perspective is way too slow. They don't know what you're doing for those other 20 days of the 22. And then you're down to, you know, 10% flow efficiency. So a value stream map helps you to understand the reason why you have low flow efficiency. But the metric I think you're looking for is from choice, from problem that we choose to solve to getting the thing solved, what percentage, how fast can we do that? Now, if it's a three-day problem, you don't want to do it in 2 days. You want to do it in 3 days or 4 days. But if it's a three-hour problem, you want to do it inside of 8 hours for sure. So it's not do the solution part faster. It's get rid of the weights.
There's a line in one of your books that it's resonating with me really soundly right now. It's you want to solve your problems so fast that your customers can't change their minds.
Yep.
And it's almost like we have this hyper-educated consumer base these days, and they are exposed to a lot of companies that embrace these things like flow efficiency and resiliency in their applications and have the ability to do these continuous delivery type changes. Mm-hmm. If your organization is not yet there, you still need to pay attention to that customer. And one thing that I find quite often when I work with a company in a consulting function with value stream maps, once they commit themselves to, say, a software bug fix to a client and you go through the value stream map, they tend to think that the downtime is only between 8 and 5 Monday to Friday because those are the core working hours, not realizing that their software as a service and their clients run on a 24-hour clock. The minute that you commit to telling
every
them
one of those hours counts.
Exactly. And it's a sobering moment sometimes for people to realize, oh, wait a minute. Yeah, I usually go with the metaphor of if your cable goes down, like your cable TV drops or your internet drops, even worse, right? If your internet drops, would you only care about how much work your internet provider gives you Monday to Friday, 8 to 5? Or do you care about that 24 hours a day? Now,
great.
What makes you better? What makes you better than your customer, right?
Great analogy.
It's that it's that moment that eyes open and mouths drop, right? And I think it is a valuable tool. It visualizes things, and it makes people feel personally accountable to the problems that they have. And it's a real change enabler within an organization.
What it does is it points out that there's all these delays, but it also shows you why. And then if you take a look at the whys, you say, well, we don't actually have to do it that way. That, you know, it isn't necessary for that step in there. It doesn't have to sit there for 5 days. Why can't it sit there for 5 hours? You start questioning all of those pauses. And sometimes just a value stream map will cause a whole bunch of rather fast fixes.
We do use it just about as much as we ever did anytime we engage a customer. And the reason is that it gives us a very quick and deep understanding of what goes on in their organization. And tells us how to adapt all the rest of the class that we teach to address the places where there are big opportunities revealed by the value stream map. The idea of flow efficiency that Mary described, in our books we call it process cycle efficiency after Michael George's work, but I think flow efficiency is a much better name for it.
So the one interesting byproduct that I run into sometimes with value stream maps are executives that get angry at the map because it exposes the reality of their system, and not realizing that that without sounding too harsh, the person they should be angry with is the person in the mirror for allowing the system to morph into what it became. And now it's on their shoulders to find the right partners to work with to navigate their way through to a better flow efficiency based system.
We have found that it's very difficult for managers to do a valid value stream map of their company. Yeah. And if we just have managers in the room, we are a little hesitant to do it. We were in one place where the managers were in the room and one sort of agile coach for each manager that was working in their area. And we did a value stream map, and the managers would have these rosy ideas about how things worked. And then the agile coach would say, no, actually, this is the way it works. And by the time that we finished drawing it, because it was their folks that had sort of contradicted them and said, that's not true, it actually works like this. So they at least began to have a clear idea of how things work. Now, then the question is, well, how dumb is that? Why are we doing things that way? Why don't people do stuff in a more obviously simple way? But that's a really good question, but that's a question they need to ask themselves. You're right.
Correct. So shifting gears a little bit, I'm going to look back again to the exercise we went through with the 14 signers that we managed to interview on this podcast. And when we spoke with Ron Jeffries, we asked him a question about one of the more obvious things with the Agile Manifesto authors was that they were all old white guys. And we asked, why no diversity? Why was it all males? Why was it all white guys? And the answer, fair answer from Ron was this was the network that we had at the time. And I think my colleague Jason Cusack would then ask the follow-up question of, if you were to do it again, knowing who you know out there, who would you invite? And the first name Ron said was Mary and Tom Poppendick. So I'm curious, have you ever taken a step back and looked at your Mary, I'm sorry, Tom, this is more for Mary, but your place as one of the leading figures of women in technology in the early days of that lean and agile emergence.
So let me ask you something first. Have you seen the movie Hidden Figures?
No, but I know what movie you're talking about. I haven't seen it.
So if you look at that movie, you will discover that the first programmers were women. And when I was a programmer, easily 40% of programmers were women. And it was like, because the job was a sort of a compute job, which turned into a programming job, it gradually turned into a job that men did, especially once, as far as I can tell, once the personal computer or the even the Commodore, the those computers that kids could get as toys became popular, parents started buying them for boys. And then when those boys got to college, then they would get into computer classes and they would know more than the girls. And as my daughter said, the girls didn't feel like they could compete in a class where the toys that the kids had gave them an edge over thinking about programming. And so it became more of a male environment than it used to be. So I've always been astonished at how few women there were when I left the programming world and I came back after about, I don't know, 6 or 8 years or so, and how few women that I found when I came back. But I definitely would like to see more women get involved in any kind of STEM activity, because to me that's just like the most fun and interesting thing that you can do. And so my daughter-in-law just got a PhD in environmental engineering, and I think that's so cool. And I really would like the whole idea that these areas, the STEM areas of are really fascinating areas for anybody to be able to do problem solving and creative thinking, and they're just plain fun. One of the things that happened to software, however, was we got to the point where software was no longer just plain fun. It was do what you're told and shut up kind of thing. And that's sort of what I found the waterfall process turned software development into. And if I were trying to get into an interesting area in the late 90s, it would not have been software, because it was such a, you know, here's your tasks, go off and do them, come back and tell me more. And if you're not careful, a Scrum environment can turn into a very much the same kind of environment. Here's your task, go off, do it, and come back, and you know, and then we'll give you the next task. What we need to do is turn all these areas that require technical thinking into areas that are engineering areas, challenging problem-solving areas. And I don't know anybody that isn't interested in coming into an area that has challenging problems to solve. And when you get women interested in challenging problems through, whether it's robot competitions or anything else like that, what you do is you create an environment where we've got a whole bunch more people that can solve the problems that this world is going to present than we do if we sort of limit it to half of the population. And that's important. So it's not just do more women want to get into software development. It's does software development provide an environment which is a challenging problem-solving environment rather than a handout tasks and tell people what to do environment. And when it gets there, then it's going to attract the kind of people that we want to solve the problems that we're going to have to solve over the future.
When I first met Mary back at the university many decades ago, it was the era where the only professional fields open to women were teaching and nursing. And in fact, Mary's master's degree is a math education degree. That late, it was still the thing that you had to do if you wanted a professional career. But then when she finished that, the programming field opened up. And as she said, there have been very many women in the field initially because it was a new field, a new profession that was open to women. And of course, in the Vietnam War, women weren't subject to the draft. So the guys were just out of college were subject to disappearing suddenly. And the women who were previously discriminated against due to their leaving after having children became much more attractive. So there were lots of females in the field at that time.
My two sisters, 1 year older than I am and 1 year younger than I am, also became programmers for their entire career.
But then the field became unattractive compared to other professional fields that gradually over the decades opened up to women. And I think that it's basically the legacy of the whole waterfall process that made the field less and less attractive to smart, intelligent people that were looking for meaningful careers that were fun and exciting, as Mary said. So there are lots of theories about why it happened, but that's the way it looked from what I saw.
Man, that was an absolute fantastic way to kind of, you know, bring this interview to a head. You know, we're coming up on the 50-minute mark, and we want to definitely be respectful of your guys' time. So we could, you know, we always end every single one of these interviews, we end up ending with, you know, we could talk to you for another an hour. And I really feel that that's true. So we want to thank you. And, really just, I mean, ending on that note is just like, it's powerful.
Yeah. So diversity is super important. And, both James and I are fathers of daughters. So making sure that there's an environment that does breed the desire of intelligent people to step into the field and to continue to solve those problems that are coming up is powerful stuff. So Mary and Tom, you guys, I know you do some teaching and some speaking and a whole plethora of different types of events. Is there anything coming up in the next few months that that you want to get in front of our listeners or other ways that they may be able to contact you?
They can always contact us at our email address or through our website, mary@popandick.com or info@popandick.com. We'll be doing a trip to Europe this fall, speaking at some conferences and talking at some companies. But other than that, we're easing slowly into retirement.
Hmm.
Actually, this whole effort has been a retirement hobby for us.
That's great.
Since 2000.
That's spectacular. And if any couple deserves it, it's probably the hardest working couple in Lean. So I hope to see some more works from you before you finally hang up the Lean lab coats. But you know, you guys definitely did deserve it. So thank you. This is again, this is the Agile Uprising. You can find us at agileuprising.com. We have the free and open network at coalition.agileuprising.com, and you can give us a follow on Twitter at Agile Uprising. And if you're listening to this podcast for the first time, consider giving us a subscribe and potentially a positive review on either the iTunes, the Stitcher, or the various different podcasting networks that you may be finding us through. Mary, Tom, one last time, thank you so much from myself, from James, from the Agile Uprising, and from all of the listeners that are going to enjoy the show.
Well, thank you very much also.
The most important thing you can do is to use and extend the ideas that we've shared.
Yes.
Thank you.
Agile leaders in the DC Metro. LiveSpeed's Agile DC Executive Summit is September 13th. The annual conference hosts DC's top lean and agile industry leaders and executives from private and public sectors. Join top-rated speakers in exploring agile digital transformation and be one of the first 50 people to register for $100 off the ticket price at agiledcsummit.com. LiveSpeed helps you make your work more productive, fulfilling, and valued. Ask about training, coaching, and consultation today.